Heritage Radio Network on tour. I'm Katie Mosman Wadler. I'm the executive director of Heritage Radio Network. We are super excited to be kicking off our live broadcast today from Slow Food Nations in Denver, Colorado, where it is a warm but dry 87-ish. And we're in a beautiful tent in Larimer Square. If you're in Denver, I hope you'll come by and visit us today. We've got a great outdoor seating area for you to come take a chill, listen to our interviews today. I want to start by saying a big thank you to Slow Food for having us, and a huge thanks to Big Green Egg and the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts for making our program possible today. My very special guest this morning, our first guest, is Paul Willis. He's the founder of the Nyman Ranch Pork Company and a member of the Heritage Radio Network Hall of Fame. Welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
We're so glad to have you. How's your weekend been going so far? We've been at Slow Food Nations for a couple days now. We had the Leader Summit yesterday.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. I met a lot of interesting people, and you know, everybody's got a story and something really of value, and so lots of conversations, and so it's been terrific.
What's on your docket today after this?
Well, besides this, I mean, I had an interview earlier. I'm going to be on a panel yet today, and then. I'm going to be on with Alice Waters later this evening, and we also have a fundraising dinner at Pete and Barbara Marzik's house, and the fundraiser is for our Nyman Ranch Scholarship Fund, which is really for the young people that are raised on the farms of our Nyman Ranch farmers, both the hog farms, beef and lamb. So. Yeah, I've got a busy schedule.
That sounds excellent. Well, we're going to come back and talk more about the scholarship in a little while. I also just got hit with a wafting smell of bacon, which is really putting me in the spirit to talk to you about hog farming today. But I would love to talk a little bit about how you got started as a farmer. And you're from Thornton, Iowa, right?
Right.
And you have a long history of sort of breaking away from industrial hog farming. So tell us about how you got your beginning and the sort of initial transitions that you started to make in hog ranching.
Okay. I grew up on a farm, Thornton, Iowa. And when I left high school, I never imagined that I would actually even return to the farm. And, went to college, was in the Peace Corps, came back. Worked a couple of years.
Where did you go in the Peace Corps?
I was in Nigeria, northeast part of Nigeria. You know where Boko Haram has been operating? That's mm-hmm. where I was.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing there?
I believe it or not, I was the Young Farmers Club organizer.
Wow.
For the northeast state.
Wow.
So we had some village level clubs. We had some that were in schools, both primary schools, secondary schools. I opened a lot of clubs, and they would have an agricultural project of some sort, and they'd decide what it was, and then we would, follow the project, try to maintain whatever the recommended practices were, and then, and it was very interesting because we had a lot of different tribal groups. Some people were Muslim, some people were Christian, some people were pagan. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a little bit different take about, how they wanted to have their club. In some clubs, actually, everybody was an officer.
Did that experience start to change your mind about farming in any ways that surprised you at the time?
Yes, I really think I really learned to appreciate ways of farming that were, different than what I had grown up with. Which was, in those days, most of the farms were kind of diversified, corn, soybeans, livestock. It just taught me to, I guess, understand that people had different ways of doing things in different places, and you didn't want to superimpose your values on somebody else of a different culture, you might say, or practices. Mm-hmm. You'd be careful about that.
Yeah. So what happened when you came back from Nigeria?
Well, I was involved in the Peace Corps recruiting for a while. I was a VISTA program officer for the state of Minnesota. And then it came up that my family needed some help on the farm. And I went down to Iowa from Minnesota. I was living in Minneapolis. And I went back to Iowa and, helped with the harvest. And then my father broke his arm and he couldn't put in the crop. I ended up planting the crop in the spring. And I had a call one day from a neighbor that said he had a sow with five pigs. And if I bought this sow, he'd just give me the pigs.
Wow.
I thought, well, that's a good idea.
Six for the price of one.
Six for the price of one. When I grew up, we had raised pigs, pasture pigs in those days. So I had I had the skill. I knew how to do it. And, I decided, well, this is pretty good. And I bought another seven females, and I borrowed a boar from the neighbor. And I was in the pig business.
Just like that.
Just like that. And the first, 5 years, and I said, well, if I'm going to be here, I'm going to, get into this farming business seriously. And I have to be more of a partner on the farming operation. But the pig side of the business, that was strictly just my thing.
Sort of started as a pet project, and
right. And so in the beginning stages, it was difficult because I was trying to build up my herd, saving a lot of breeding stock back, and to get a little size to it. So that means you don't have anything to sell. Mm-hmm. What normally you'd be selling as a market pig, you were saving as breeding stock. So eventually they would reach, they'd go to market, but it was a cash flow problem. So that was a struggle, and I remember that experience, and we can relate that now because it has something to do with helping out some of our people getting into becoming Nyman Ranch hog farmers mm-hmm. today. But
so
anyway,
you started with, just for context, you started with one sow and five baby pigs,
that's
and
right.
Then quickly that grew to 12. How many hogs right now is Nyman Ranch raising at a time?
Well, just myself, within about 5 years, I was raising around 3,000 head a year.
Wow.
So this was a fairly large
operation. This got out of hand
operation.
Quickly.
Yeah, maybe it was a little longer than that, but I continued to grow, and I was making money. It was profitable. I was getting ahead in the farming world. And about this time, the push for industrially raised pigs started moving into Iowa. It had been prominent in North Carolina, and they were coming, telling us we had to get bigger, get out. We should put up one of these large confinement buildings, and you couldn't make a living unless you had, thousands of sows and things like this. And
is this the point where contract farming is becoming a big part of the industry, or is that separate from the sort of industrialization?
All of those things were kind of advancing at the same time, and so there were all types of different operations, and some people were abandoning their outdoor kind of raising pigs, some farmers put up these buildings. First they were smaller, then they got bigger, but for the most part, most of the these industrial buildings were put up by larger companies. Mm-hmm. And then they would hire, maybe make some kind of a deal for the manure disposal, things like that. All kinds of different scenarios. But it was advancing very rapidly. And I was actually starting to be squeezed out of the marketplace. And I didn't like that. I was in California visiting my sister. I saw a woman buy a organic chicken and pay maybe double or triple. And I said, well, why are you buying this organic free-range chicken. Oh, she said, oh, it tastes better. It's worth it. I'm thinking, well, why don't we have free-range pigs, you know? That was a thought, you know, kind of the thought process. And about this time, microbreweries were sort of coming onto the scene, you know, specialty brands mm-hmm. for things. And I always thought, well, you know, we should have a specialty brand.
Give a sense of what year this thought process is taking place.
This was in the, I'd say probably in the late 80s or early 90s. So I started looking for a way to sell my pasture-raised pigs. But I, you know, and there were people that wanted to buy, you know, pork chop or part or something. And I wasn't raising pork chops. I'm raising animals, you know. You sell the entire animal. And it goes back to my Peace Corps experience. One of my colleagues, Jeannie McCormick, had been in my training group, and I found out she had moved back to the ranch in Rio Vista, California. And I went out to see her and her husband, and they were raising lamb, and they're telling me about this guy that was helping market their lamb. That was Bill Nyman.
Ah.
And I said, well, I have to meet him. We went to the burger joint in San Francisco the next day, and we were excited. And he was the first person that understood that I'm, you know, you're raising livestock. You have to, you know, find a place for all of the livestock, all of the parts. And he said, well, send me some pork. And we sent it. I went home, just took it out of the freezer, shipped it to San Francisco, and they sent it out to some of the restaurants, including Chez Panisse. And Alice Waters is here right today. I'm going to be on a panel with her later. But she was instrumental in the, I mean, they loved the quality from an eating standpoint. And Bill said, well, send me 30 pigs. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea how does this process work. And I went and I found a packing plant that would do custom work. And they filled me in on how this all, you know, the logistics happens. How does a live animal get from your farm and end up? And Bill said, by the way, it has to be there 5:30 Monday morning.
Great. No problem.
No problem.
We got you, Bill.
Yeah. So that was it. That actually happened in 95.
Was it hard to find a processor at that time? Is that becoming easier or harder for your farmers?
Well,
I mean, now you have economies of scale, but for somebody who is a small pork producer to find a way to get that process.
It's a nationwide problem. With the exception of some of the areas like the Midwest, we have, you know, you have some large processing plants, packing plants. I was fortunate in Iowa, we had what we call a medium-sized plant that processed a couple thousand animals a day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's compared to a large plant that processes 36,000 a day. But much different than a locker plant that, you know, handles maybe 5 head or something, and it's costly.
Mm-hmm.
So I found this plant, the first place I went, and they were helpful. They helped me figure it out because I had no idea how this works. Okay. You know, the trucking and how does it. You know, what do you do? Cut it? You know, is it a hanging carcass or is it a? Anyway, we did this, but the problem with processing is, it's a problem for small producers,
mm-hmm.
and it's expensive when you mm-hmm. find it.
So, it sounds like for so many food startups, sort of getting initial buy-in from chefs and from people who are really influential in the space can be really critical to getting kind of that early success. Fast forward, Nyman Ranch is a household name, and we can find your products in almost every grocery store that I walk into, at least. How now is Nyman sort of setting itself apart from industrial agriculture? How would you define sort of the difference between industrial hog farming and the sustainable hog farming of Nieman Ranch?
Well, right from the beginning, I wanted to differentiate what we were doing from commodity production. And a big cornerstone of it is the animal welfare aspect. We're raising animals that they're either on pasture or deep bedding. And we, right from the beginning, I started working with Diane Halverson. At that time, was with the Animal Welfare Institute. But I wanted that. I wanted that sort of stamp of approval, and we have that yet today. You know, we don't allow gestation stalls. We don't allow farrowing crates. The animals have to have bedding. We further advanced things like no antibiotics ever, vegetarian diet, and they have to be owned and raised by independent farmers. Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference. And the end product is dramatically different also.
The end product is dramatically different, and so many people, especially like the people who are here today at Slow Food Nations, people who understand sort of the values of purchasing and procurement that is not going through the industrial meat system, are keenly aware of, there is always going to be a cost premium. What are you thinking about in terms of making good meat accessible?
Well, even though we're a meat company, we advocate maybe eating less meat and eating better meat. You know, some meat that has that tastes great, but also has other values and supports farmers. It's good for the, it's better for the animals, better for the farmers, better for the environment, ultimately better for the customer. All those things, we have some customers that are like universities, and we've done come a long ways to have maybe a meat be an ingredient, not necessarily a center of the plate. Mm-hmm. Not that you can't have that sometimes, but there's ways of, I think yesterday we had some beef adobo or something on some kind of like a lettuce wrap or something, and it was just maybe an ounce or two, and it was flavorful and delicious. Yeah. So there's ways of stretching your, but we're raising a special product, and I guess the other thing I have to say is that we, right from the beginning, I wanted to make sure that our farmers were paid a fair and equitable price. Bill Nieman asked me when I first met, what do you want for your pigs? And I came up with a price, which was a really good price, but not unreasonable. And it was the first time, honestly, anybody had ever asked me what I wanted for an animal that I was raising, and I could put a value on my, labor and all the costs of production.
Mm-hmm. At this point, how rare is it for a farmer to be able to set their own price?
I think if you're raising something special, I don't think it's rare. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between commodity food production, whether it's grain or vegetables or livestock. If you have something special, that gives you that privilege, I guess you might say. Mm-hmm. And our what we pay our farmers covers all of their costs of production and gives them a profit. And if the commodity market would go up, we continue to raise our price because we're always paying better. And if it goes down, we don't go down with the. And so because of the tariffs and things like that, I mean, the past year, our premium to our farmers has been almost 100%.
Wow.
It's very attractive for people in our program at this point.
So since you mentioned tariffs, you're in Iowa. Pretty exciting times right now. you said earlier we were chatting, you said you've been getting a lot of traffic from a lot of political candidates right now. Who's talking about food policy, and how important is that as a campaign issue in Iowa?
Well, you can't come to Iowa and not talk about, I would call it maybe agricultural policy. And they're not talking about food quite so much as, you know, we have things like ethanol production there. And, you know, right or wrong, it's still popular within the state. And almost every candidate that I've met, about 10 different candidates, and most people are pretty well versed. They, I mean, not everybody, but a lot of people, you can tell they've done some homework, and they know they need to, you know, they don't need to be coming there and looking really foolish.
Yeah. Have issues like the pork tariffs swayed mass public opinion?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I would think that every farmer would, because of that, not support that side of the, you know. However, that's not necessarily the case. They're like, oh, you know, it's going to be better in the long run. It amazes me, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. As we're thinking about agriculture policy and kind of what we see and hear in the news, particularly around pork farming, there are a lot of externalities, particularly with industrial agriculture, but really with any agriculture, as far as impact on the environment and impact on people, and even further downstream, impact on health of people who consume these products. And, you know, currently very few of these externalities wind up being paid for by the producers. And, you know, we hear about overflowing waste lagoons, destroying local watersheds, and you know, a lot of really horrific things that are going on that nobody is really paying for on the production side of things. Obviously, that's going to be a lot different on a different scale of agriculture and with different practices where animals are outside on grass, they're not being held in pens, and waste isn't accumulating in the same way. But how do you approach holding producers responsible for the cost of the externalities that they produce?
Okay, so animals produce manure, mm-hmm. but our animals that are, if they're out on pasture or they're in a bedded situation where the manure is mixed in with the bedding, and it you know, it's usually put out in a big compost pile, and it's spread, and it doesn't get into the water system easily because it's tied up in the organic material. The confinement operations have liquid manure below the buildings. We don't have the lagoons like they do in North Carolina, but you know, so there's a rush between, you know, in the fall after the crops are out before the ground freezes, or in the spring before you plant, to empty these pits, and it's injected into the ground. And often over-applied. And there was a study recently in one of the counties in the northwest part of the state, and they measured the amount of effluent coming out of the hog facilities and the amount of commercial purchased fertilizer, and compared it to the land base, and they found that the application was double of what the land base would allow. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it just seems actually just like an enormous waste of money, if nothing else. So you have this double application of nitrogen and phosphate and everything. So when it rains, we have you know what drainage tile are?
No.
Well, the upper Midwest water, our problem is we have too much water, and a lot of the land is glaciated, and there's a lot of potholes. They're depressions where they're little wetlands or marshes. So when the Europeans came, they knew how to drain this, and the original tile, maybe a 4 to 6 inch diameter, about 18 inches long, was dug into the ground, put in about 3 foot deep, laid to grade, and then the little cracks between each tile the water would percolate in, and that's how the land was drained. Now they put in plastic tile, and you can put it in with a great big plow, and there's millions of miles of drainage tile,
Wow.
And so when it rains, if you've got excess nutrients, it gets into the tile, and it's like a tree branch system. The bigger ones, the small ones run into bigger ones. Eventually they run into an open either drainage ditch or a river, and it goes down to Mississippi and creates a dead zone.
I had no idea there was so much plastic being laid underground.
Yeah, it comes in big,
huge
coils.
Wow. So what do we do about that? We can try to regulate, you know, confinement producers. We can send them a bill for all the rivers they killed. We can try to convince people to only buy Niman Ranch pork. What do we do?
Well, I would like to think that we'd have the political will. The country of Denmark had a similar problem in the entire country a few years ago. But they're a smaller country, and the country in general decided, you know, enough is enough. We want to clean up our water. And within something like 5 years, they did. They cleaned up all their water and, all of the streams. You could fish in them. They hadn't for a whole generation. So there's that, but it's hard to do. You have a lot of agribusiness, buying your politics and things like that, and controlling the legislature to... So let me give you an example. We're encouraging cover crops, and cover crops are helpful in cleaning up the water, and they prevent erosion, and, you know, they have all kinds of benefits. But it's a voluntary program. So the Iowa Environmental Council just last week or two did a kind of a check to see where we were and the amount of acres that are in cover crops and how long would it take. And at the present rate, in the volunteer cover crops rate, it will take 90 years to get this accomplished. So I think you have to put... You have to pass some laws to make it required, you know, but that's not easy to do.
Sure.
So whether it's a state or a national thing, but anyway, it frustrates me.
Yeah, we can't keep
sitting
on it. Yeah.
But we at Niman Ranch, at least we're doing what we think is, we're doing our part the best we can. And it's a big improvement over commodity agriculture in general.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, it's still a, even though we have over 750 farmers and ranchers now, you know, in the big picture, that's still a small number.
Let's talk more about who the farmers are, and you guys are doing some really cool work to help younger farmers get into business. I think we've all heard some really frightening statistics about the average age of a farmer in the U.S. Farmers are aging out of the profession, and young farmers have a really hard time getting started. They have a hard time getting access to land. It's really difficult to become financially sustainable. How are you guys looking to solve that problem?
Okay, so I told you about how it was hard to get started with, you know, because I was trying to build up the breeding stock, and we actually gave away breeding stock to young farmers last year to the tune of $300,000.
Wow.
And, you know, people could apply, and they had to be new farmers or young farmers, and they might get 10 gilts, which are the young sows. There are no strings attached. And that's a big help, just, you know, getting going.
What would have been the market price for those 10 pigs?
I'd say around $250 a head.
Mm-hmm. So that's a big jump.
So it's, you know, one of the farmers that started, he got 40 head.
Wow.
You know, that's equivalent about $10,000 or so. But, yeah, you know, and it doesn't go unnoticed, because not everybody gets it, but, you know, so we're... That's one of the things. We might go to a bank or something like this if they need. The banker doesn't understand our type of agriculture. You know, help people with financing.
So you're helping independent farmers get access to credit, or are they part of the Nyman Ranch network at that point? How does that work?
They could be part of the network new to the Nyman Ranch network, perhaps. Yeah. But not many people have pull out their wallet and pay a feed bill. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have very many pigs, and you start having thousands of dollars. Every time you grind a load of feed, it's, 6 ton of feed at $300 a ton or something, it adds up.
And for something like hog farming, you don't have income right away. So this kind of access to capital issue, I would think, would be a really big barrier for a lot of people starting off.
And another thing is we provide funding interest-free loans to farmers that want to buy breeding stock. So, in that respect, if you buy breeding stock, that's an asset. And if you keep that sow for a couple of years and then sell the sow, you have enough to pay all that money back.
Wow. How long is a sow in production?
Well, on my farm, for example, we would have they can have about 2 litters of pigs per year, and if they did well, I was always saving some breeding stock to replace. If they didn't do well, they probably went to market. Mm-hmm. But if they did well, I might keep them, 2, 3, 4 years.
Okay.
But you are in business, and if they're not productive, or in some cases, they might not get bred at all, mm-hmm. and you don't know why. They might have 1 litter of pigs, but that's it.
Yeah. So, just briefly, because we are Heritage Radio Network, we have a lot of particular affinity for heritage breeds. What are your practices as far as, like, what breeds of pigs are you using for Nyman Ranch?
Most of our pigs are crossbred pigs. And a good starting point is a Chester White, Duroc, Berkshire three-way cross. And each one of those breeds brings something to the Chester White will have more pigs, but the meat quality is pretty good. Duroc will grow a little faster. The Berkshire, but that you get heterosis, which is that the offspring will be better than both of the parents. Mm-hmm. We're not generally raising like Mangalista or something like that, but we're using these breeds. And, it depends on what your definition of heritage is, mm-hmm. But.
What do these pigs have in common with industrially farmed pigs?
Well, they will interbreed.
Okay. They're technically the same species.
They're the same species, but the type of pig that that we raise outdoors, they have more intermuscular fat, they carry more body fat, they get they have bigger body cavities where their lungs and internal organs are because of the exercise they get. Mm-hmm. Our pigs thrive outdoors. They can handle heat. They can handle cold weather. The industrial, other white meat, lean pig, they can hardly survive in an outdoor situation, mm-hmm. just because they don't have enough body cover, and they easily get stressed or sick. And our pigs tend to be more calm.
Yeah. So they're happier.
They're happy.
Definitely happier.
Happier.
Yeah. I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the scholarship program. We're almost out of time, but you mentioned at the top of the show that you guys have a fundraiser coming up this weekend. So do you still have tickets for the fundraiser available? Can anyone listening still attend?
No tickets for tonight's event. We're sold out, which is great.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. And it'll be at Pete and Barbara Marzik's house, and they're Marzik Markets here in Denver. They have 2 stores. They carry all Nyman products, and they were wonderful partners, and they've decided this is what we're doing, and these scholarships go to the kids of our farmers. Mm-hmm. And you've heard a lot about people getting out of school with huge debt and things like this.
I know a little something about that.
You're right. So we have, in fact, Jacqueline Knutson is a former recipient. She's in around here somewhere. And she graduated and announced yesterday on a panel that I was on, she graduated debt-free.
Wow.
That's not awesome. That she didn't have work hard too, you know,
sure.
But we definitely helped her, and you know, we encourage people that are going to back to the farm or the rural communities. And last year we and this is through the partnership of many of our customers and you know, different sources of in these little fundraising things. Some chefs have put on dinners, and we raised a something like $130,000.
Wow.
It's really,
that's,
and
awesome.
It started the first time we did this, we were giving people a scholarship of $100 or something.
Mm-hmm. So it's all grown from there.
It's grown from there, and it's really appreciated by the families, and I mean, despite the fact that, you know, our farmers are in business, it's still hard go. It's hard work, and nobody's getting, you know, it's if you're looking for the millionaire train, you know.
Hog farming isn't that.
No, maybe not. Maybe it is.
Could be. Maybe one day.
Yeah.
We got to get our policies sorted out first.
Right.
But we're on our way. Well, I wish you guys a very successful fundraiser. Paul, I want to say thank you again for joining us on Heritage Radio Network. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. And I love Heritage Radio, and you're doing some great work.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I want to say a huge thank you again to our sponsors for this weekend, Big Green Egg and the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. You can listen live all weekend at heritageradionetwork.org/live. We'll also be publishing these interviews as podcasts under Heritage Radio Network on Tour, on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll be back shortly after a quick break.